Good morning to you all. You've had already had a wonderful start today. Second annual Summer Policy Institute. Do a bit of a self-plug, perhaps, on the margin, since I am on the board of directors of the Oklahoma Policy Institute. I will say that those of you who have chosen to attend this several-day session, interested in Oklahoma government and politics and public policy making, you couldn't have chosen, I think, a more informative and useful use of your time. My involvement on the board is based on a commitment to the principle of having public fiscal policies adequate to the health and the prosperity of the state, and in dealing with this question with accurate data and information on the basis of making the most responsible decisions that we possibly can about good public policy. Let me introduce myself. My name is John Fever, and I am sometimes a college president, and on other occasions I act like one. And I'll let you decide what I'm doing this morning. I'll be serving as your panel moderator, and it is my wonderful privilege to do so with this panel stuffed with terrific talent, expertise, and knowledge, and they're going to focus, following David's presentation this morning, on Oklahoma's fiscal challenges, what we face in Oklahoma in the course of raising revenue to fund local and state government and services. Most of you know, I suspect, who our six panelists are, but I am going to briefly introduce them. The Senate President pro tem, Senator Brian Bingaman, is with us this morning. The state treasurer is with us, Dr. Ken Miller. The House Minority Leader, Representative Scott Inman, is with us. The Finance Director of the City of Norman, Anthony Francisco, is with us. And Amanda Ewing is with us. She is Associate Executive Director of the Oklahoma Education Association, and Professor Dan Rickman from the Department of Economics at Oklahoma State University. These are varying perspectives on the issue of fiscal challenges, two from the legislature, one from the perspective of state government, one from the standpoint of someone who has responsibility for municipal government, one individual from one of the major beneficiaries of state fiscal policy, and we're going to rely on Dr. Rickman for scholarly perspective. I'm going to ask the six individuals to give a brief opening comment of 5 to 6 to 6.4 minutes. And in front here, David is going to act as a timekeeper. And so why don't we just begin down at the other end, Dan, and let you take off, and then we'll just follow on down and wind up with Anthony here at the end. Dan.
Good morning. It's nice to see so many young people interested in the issues we have facing us. So David asked me if I would participate, and I was happy to, though I'm always worried about what I say will be received by some. But I'll start off saying I sat through David's presentation this morning, which was excellent, and there wasn't really much that I could disagree, so maybe I had some additional thoughts on various aspects. I guess what I would look at it as a regional and urban economist, and the way we look at the health and growth of an economy, I would say that Oklahoma needs to play the long game, just put it really simply. We have not been playing the long game, and we need to. What do I mean by the long game? Long-term fundamental factors determine economic prosperity, not short-run sort of policy levers and movements. They're fundamental factors that cause us to grow and to prosper. And primarily, what we always want to think about is, how does what we do make this a more attractive place to start a business, a more attractive place to live? And usually anything we do has two sides to it. So sometimes somebody will point out one side and say, well, that makes it a better place for business. But on the other hand, there might be something that makes it less attractive. And so economists like to point out we need to look at all sides of every issue that comes up. So I kind of tried to boil it down into three points that I'd like to make, some of what you heard from David already. First and foremost, I'd just say Oklahoma needs to adequately fund education and infrastructure, and it has not been. I'm just going to point blank say it. If you take out the energy industry and you take out energy-related manufacturing, our state is not outperforming the nation. We did well because of energy, and it is an important part of our economy, but you take that out, we're not outperforming the rest of the country. So we need to pay attention to that side of the economy as well. If you look at Tulsa and Oklahoma City, for instance, and a lot of the data we get from metropolitan areas, if you look at the share of the labor force and the population that are college graduates, they're much lower than the average for the 100 largest metropolitan areas in the country. What factors underlie this? Well, there's a demand and a supply side, but increasingly, the areas that have college graduates are the ones who are going to be doing well. If you take 1970, I think it was about 26% of college graduates lived in the top 20 most educated cities. Now it's about half. Almost half of the college graduates in this country live in the top 20 most educated cities. This is where prosperity is going to occur. If we're not part of that, we're not going to have the same prosperity. I'm not saying energy isn't unhelpful, and we're very thankful we have it, but we're not going to rely completely on it. We hear a lot of talk about widening inequality and sort of spread of income across individuals. This is going to happen geographically. Increasingly, you're going to see those areas with those college graduates and those industries that are growing because of that doing much better than those regions of the country that do not. So I think that that's just something that's going to continue. Underfunding education does not help our cause. Now, both of my children are out of K-12. I think K-12 is where our most pressing needs are. So I have no vested interest other than the citizen of Oklahoma. I can see it in Stillwater. I see the number of AP course offerings going down. I see quality teachers are leaving because of the funding. I see average ACT scores going down. That's what I can just see around me. That's a problem. That's the first thing I think we need to address. Now, how do we fund that? That brings me to my next two points. This is where it gets controversial, but that's what happens to us as economists. First of all, and the things I'm going to say are pretty much accepted by everybody I work with around the country and do research with, so it's not really sort of just an odd point of view that I have. Reduce reliance on financial incentives that are awarded to companies. These are not passing any cost-benefit analyses. I don't know of any businesses that undertake projects without looking to see whether it's going to increase net present value in the future. We don't do that. The academic evidence is highly suspect. We do not see evidence that a large use of this is really contributing to stronger growth in our economy or any economy that's using it more than others. Yet we just use it just without thinking that, it's going to create jobs, it's going to create jobs. What's going to create jobs is making this a place that people who want to live and businesses want to live. And a lot of these businesses would have come anyways, and we never really know if we're just simply giving them if we're just giving those incentives out. So I don't think we can completely eliminate it. We start needing to subject them to more cost-benefit analyses. Brings us to the energy industry. I happen to agree with David. These resources are here. They're not going anywhere. The resources are only going to get more valuable in the future. We don't have to incentivize their extraction. North Dakota and Wyoming are using this to fund education. Their teachers are better paid. Research I'm doing right now shows our teachers are very underpaid, and it has consequences in terms of retention of teachers. So this is something we really should use resources to our advantage. Third thing that I would say, since I'm really getting out of time, is paying for, quit simply reducing, thinking of reducing state income taxes. The evidence does not suggest that they're worse than sales taxes in terms of attracting people to live here. You know, government services are needed. Taxes are the price we pay. What are the best way to pay for services we need? What do we most need? How do we most efficiently pay for them? That's a conversation we should be having. Simply trying to boil it down to one sort of rhetorical point. Oh, we got to reduce the state income tax, or we need to do this. It's more complicated that there's a balance. There's a balance. We need to fund our government services. It's not the only tax we raise. It's not the only tax you could cut. Like David said, you could cut groceries, make groceries exempt from sales tax. That would affect more people than anything in terms of a tax. So there's a more complete conversation we can have, and we got to kind of get past the rhetorical points. Instead of saying, you know, this will create jobs or that create jobs, you need to think about the totality. Our economy is a system. Any change you make affects the system in more than one way. And you have to count both sides of the ledger when you consider these changes. That's what I would really like to see, is a changing of our thinking and of our conversation. I think we'd have much better policies if we did that. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Amanda Ewing with the Oklahoma Education Association. Just quickly, for those of you who don't know, the OEA is a professional association representing members of the Oklahoma public education profession. We currently represent over 35,000 members who are current or retired teachers, administrators, education support professionals, or college and graduate students who intend to go into the teaching profession. At OEA, we frequently say that a teacher's working environment is a student's learning environment. Because when students receive all they need to learn, whether that's up-to-date textbooks, healthy meals, state-of-the-art technology, etc., a teacher's job improves immensely. There are fewer disruptions in class when students aren't hungry, when they don't have to share a desk, when the number of students in class is conducive to each one receiving individual attention when they need it. So we believe that providing students with what they need to learn nearly always equates to providing teachers with what they need to teach. And the corollary is true. When teachers receive adequate pay, when they know they'll receive a livable retirement after a lifetime of public service in the classroom, when they feel their classrooms are safe from violence, all of these things enhance our ability to recruit and retain Oklahoma's best and brightest to the teaching profession. And when we do that, our students benefit the most. Unfortunately, in many schools throughout Oklahoma, we are a long way from providing the best environments for either teaching or learning. When you compare Oklahoma's funding of common education to the rest of the country, nearly everywhere else is placing a higher value on their students and teachers than we are. Every state in the country except two spend more per pupil educating their students than in Oklahoma. Every other state in the country except one pays their teachers more than we do in Oklahoma. An Oklahoma teacher can go to any bordering state and receive a significant pay raise, which we see happening, and that's one of the reasons we have an extensive teacher shortage in this state. 36% of our fourth graders don't read on grade level, 28% of our eighth graders don't do math on grade level, and 23% of our high school students don't graduate on time. The last decade particularly has not been good for public education funding in Oklahoma. Between 2008 and 2013, Oklahoma cut the number of dollars they spend on each student by a larger percentage than any other state in the country. Our legislature has increased that funding in the past 2 years, but despite that, today, in 2014, we still spend about $175 million less on public education than we did in 2008. But at the same time, we now educate over 40,000 more students, and we do it with 1,500 fewer teachers. In Oklahoma law, we actually define what a school must do to be considered an accredited public school. There are good standards in law that we set over 20 years ago, requiring things like meeting specific student-to-teacher ratios, having a certain number of guidance counselors for so many students, buying new textbooks or new library materials every so many years. But rather than raising those standards over the past 2 decades, we've stopped even trying to meet them. The funding for Oklahoma's public schools is now so low that our elected officials understand it's absolutely not possible for our schools to meet those standards and maintain their accreditation. So what's our solution? So far, it's been to exempt all public schools from the standards. For years, we've been putting a moratorium on these accreditation standards and not requiring schools to meet them. We now say in our statutes that schools can put the money that should go toward buying textbooks to their day-to-day operations. And frankly, it's a necessary solution right now, considering that the state our schools are in and the lack of funding they have to address their greatest needs and problems. Schools have to prioritize keeping buses running to just get kids to school before they worry about how outdated their textbooks are. They have to prioritize hiring new teachers to accommodate increased enrollment before they can worry about buying any books for the library that were written in the last 15 years. We don't have the money to do everything we need to do, everything we should do. So for years, we've been telling our public schools, well, then fine, just don't do it. Previously, we'd extended this moratorium on meeting accreditation standards until June of 2014. But in the past legislative session, in Senate Bill 1469, once again, we kicked that can down the road, and now we've extended the moratorium until June of 2016. Funding isn't the only problem in public schools, but the fact is a state cannot provide a quality public education first and foremost unless it's willing to fund it. That's not to say Oklahoma schools aren't doing well. Consider that while we're nearly last in all aspects of education funding, the Annie E. Casey Foundation, a respected organization with the mission of providing improving the future of disadvantaged children and families, actually ranks Oklahoma 39th in the country for educating our children. So Oklahoma schools are rising above this dismal funding situation and achieving more than several states that fund education more than we do. We have good teachers, invested parents, innovative administrators in Oklahoma who do much more than we should expect considering the resources they have to work with. But the important question is, where would we be in this state if we weren't asking our schools to make the best of some of the worst situations in the country? What could we do if we placed a higher priority on our public schools and our students? We hear time and again what a business-friendly state this is. But all the favorable workers' compensation laws or corporate tax breaks in the world aren't going to bring world-class businesses to Oklahoma. They're not going to bring high-paying jobs to this state if we don't have an educated, highly skilled workforce for them to employ. If the phrase holds true, you get what you pay for, then Oklahoma should have one of the worst public education systems in the country. Fortunately, our schools are not the worst in the country, but they aren't in good shape and they're not going to get any better if we continue on our current course. And education is just one core government service of many we are watching be eroded by years of insufficient funding. We have a revenue problem in this state. We have to put more revenue toward our essential public services, and we need more leaders who are willing to stand up and make that case to the public, who are willing to make the tough choices to put policy over politics and fund the government functions that Oklahomans have a right to expect.
Good morning. My name is Scott Inman, and I have the privilege to serve as the Democratic leader in the Oklahoma State House of Representatives. I want to congratulate each and every one of you for being here today to think of how many students are in the Oklahoma higher education system, and to think that some 50 of you or whatnot got to participate in this program really says a lot about you, because I know a lot about this organization, its staff members and its board of directors, and they are second to none. And so if they have selected you to participate in this program, that says a great deal about you, and you ought to be commended for it. I wish I, as a student from the University of Oklahoma, when I was there going to undergrad and law school, I wish I would have had this opportunity. I think I would have been a better legislator, a better citizen, to be honest with you, in general, if I would have had this opportunity. So please take advantage of it. Take full advantage of it. Now, I want to thank David, as the other panelists have, and OK Policy for inviting me here today. Although I'm a little skeptical as to his ultimate motives, he says, well, we want you to come here because we value your input and your insight. And while there may be some scintilla of truth to that, I think that it's more like the panda effect, where people just want to see that an actual elected Democrat still exists in Oklahoma. And so I'm here. So there's like a handful of us, but no. Regardless of that, I'll say just a couple of comments, and then I'll let my other colleagues speak. I share similar concerns that the previous panelists have mentioned. I've served 8 years in the House. I am not overly encouraged about Oklahoma's economic future. And it's not that we don't have great business leaders and great citizens and great educators. We do have all of those. But I think the budgetary process at 23rd and Lincoln and the legislative and executive leadership that we have at 23rd and Lincoln is just severely lacking in a proper vision for the future of Oklahoma's economy. And what I mean by that is this. We have more folks elected into office who would rather govern by theory and ideology than by reality and practicality. And what I mean by that is you have people that legitimately think they would rather trust what Art Laffer thinks about economics, what the Laffer curve think, what they would rather trust Art Laffer, even in spite of the fact that 30 years have debunked his theories, and not just 30 years, the last 18 months in the state of Kansas have debunked his theories. They'd rather believe Art Laffer's theory than look at the reality and practicality of what this state is and where our economy is. When you take what we've done with oil and gas, when you take what we've done by passing this past year a series of tax cuts that'll take effect over the next couple of years, in spite of the fact that budget cuts have been hammering our core functions of government, you think, you scratch your head and go, why would you do that? Why would you take public education that's been cut as poorly as it has been and cut income taxes on top of it? Well, the only justification for that is if you truly believe the theory and ideology that, well, cutting those income taxes is somehow going to bring more money back into the state so that we can grow the economy. Well, I want you to ask yourself this question. Those of you who are politically astute, and I assume by your presence here today, that means all of you are, think of those politicians who espouse those tax cuts and who worship at the feet of Grover Norquist and Art Laffer, and think of all that they've said over their lifetime in a political career. How many of them do you actually believe want to cut taxes so much so that we can bring more money into the state coffers so that we can grow government more, right? That's laughable. Of course that's not true. They understand. They understand that at the core function of these tax cuts is to reduce revenue such that you can reduce state government. And guess what? They've worked. The problem is when you talk about government in terms of some sort of 30,000-foot perspective, you say, government's bad. You go out to our constituency, say, well, government's bad. We don't need too much government. Everybody says, you're right. Attaboy, you're exactly right. But when you actually talk about what government means to you and to your children and grandchildren, to your grandparents, all of a sudden it changes. The perspective changes. You say, well, do you like government? They say, no. Well, do you want to make sure we spend enough on public schools? Absolutely. Matter of fact, if you don't, they have 30,000 teachers and parents rally at the state capitol. They have a superintendent who just 4 years ago became basically the first Republican superintendent in state history that got thrown out on her rear end overwhelmingly by her Republicans, not by Democrats and independents, but by her own party, because we didn't do enough for public education. You say, well, what about nursing homes and hospitals? Oh, no, we got to fund those properly. Well, that's part of government. What about roads and bridges? Oh, no, they're miserable in Oklahoma. We need to do better. Well, that takes money. What about corrections? No, we need to improve that. Highway patrol, public safety. Oh, no, we need to improve that. Well, so what we need to do, those of us who care about the future of the state of Oklahoma, we need to talk about Oklahoma and its future in terms of actually what those programs are: education, healthcare, public safety, and how this economic process at 23rd and Lincoln has severely damaged them, not only today, but I believe going forward in the future. And if we do that, then and only then will we be able to get elected officials to hopefully open up their eyes and say, you know what, these things really do matter, and I'm no longer going to govern by theory and ideology. I'm going to start looking at the reality and the practicality of my decisions. And if they'll do that, then Oklahoma's budget future will hopefully improve. Thank you.
Mr. President, thank you for being here to moderate today. And David, certainly want to say thank you to you and your Oklahoma Policy Institute. The information that you provide to legislators is very helpful, and I certainly enjoy your monthly letter and information that you send out every year. And I want to commend all the students who are here today for being here to listen to us, and hopefully some of the questions that you ask us, maybe we can gain in that also. A little bit about myself. I live in Sapulpa. I consider myself a citizen legislator. Most of us in the legislature have private sector jobs. It's a part-time position. We have 149 legislators, so you can imagine all the ideas and pieces of legislation that get filed every year. So it is very, very challenging. I hear always, y'all probably heard this before about the doctor that tells you you've got 4 months to live. Well, if I've got 4 months to live, I want it to be during that four-month legislative session because it's the longest 4 months of my life. So, but truly, I've really enjoyed my experience in the state legislature. When I was your age, I attended the University of Oklahoma, and I really had no desire. I thought, no offense, but my freshman year at OU, the one of the courses on government was the most boring course I thought in the whole wide world. So I had no aspirations whatsoever getting involved in the legislature. But later in life, I served, got involved in city politics, served on the city council, was mayor of Sapulpa for 10 years. It was a nonpartisan, non-paying job, and always something I enjoyed, showing up at every meeting going, hey, if you can do a better job, you can have this job. So it took me 10 years to find someone to take my place. But 2004, I ran for the state legislature and served with my good friend Ken Miller. We came in 2004 in the state house. They kicked me out after 2 years and sent me over to the Senate. And due to term limits, the 12 years, I was just reelected in June for my final 2 years in the legislature. So during that time, I served in the you're happy I'm gone? Yes. believe me, there's some others that wish I was gone too, but I've learned a lot, and I appreciate the both sides of the aisle, and there are different perspectives to everything, and certainly with my background being energy, I was a petroleum land manager, had an energy management degree from University of Oklahoma, so certainly energy, I know what that does to the economy and the jobs. You look at our unemployment rate in Oklahoma, today we're sitting anywhere from 5 to under 5%, one of the lowest, in the country. So that tells me we're doing a lot of things right. Is there room for change? Is there room to do things better? Absolutely. And that's an argument that we have every year. And you want to talk about our budget, what we go through in 4 months' time. No, I don't think that's enough time for us really to, I think we just kind of scratched the surface on the job that we do on the appropriation process. I think our treasurer may get into some of our appropriations, but right now the legislature, we only appropriate about a little over 40%, 44%, I think, of actual money that comes into state government. And that's been shrinking over the last couple of years, and so that is probably a huge mistake that we've made in the legislature, that it is our job, incumbent upon the legislature, to get involved, sit down with the state agencies, thoroughly in depth, and find out really what their critical needs are. And that's very difficult to do in a lot of the budget sessions that we go through, where you spend 15, 30 minutes with an agency head who really knows how to, I'll say, game the system. And the little bit of information they provide to legislators, and based upon that limited time and the information that we have, the decisions that we have to make, plus for the strong lobbying that comes into play into the legislature, people coming in and kind of giving their views on, what's critical, where the money needs to go. I think every year we have about $1 billion worth of requests for new money to be appropriated in the state. And over the last several years, we've had a little excess money, but after 2008, 2009, the big recession that hit the state, a lot of challenges in the state. So it's always very challenging, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. And again, I think there is certainly room for improvement, and would certainly entertain your questions today, and looking for ways that we can improve the way we do business in the state of Oklahoma. So thank you for allowing me to be here.
Good morning. It is great to be here, and it's fun to be with the other panelists like you. I've enjoyed hearing what each has to say, because each comes from a different perspective and has something valuable to contribute. David, right there. Yeah, thank you for what you do. You probably don't hear that a lot from people on my side of the aisle, but OPI does, I think, do good work, and they provide valuable data to the process, because we need good and reliable data, and that's one thing that people don't criticize about OPI is their data is good. Now, some will disagree with the prescriptions that they offer, but it does provide balance because certainly in our state we have think tanks on the other side that will promote their prescriptions, and not everybody agrees with those. And so having the two does provide some balance. And so I applaud you for getting this group started, and thank you for what you all do. Let's start out with a quick story that that my deputy that's here with me is tired of hearing, but it speaks to a point I hope to make. I have an older brother, and a lot of you probably have, you know, an older brother or sister or younger, and you know how those relationships go. And in fact, my brother and I both grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and we both left when we were 18. My brother, being a few years older, came out to Oklahoma in 82 to go to college, and I eventually followed him here. Now we're trying to get our mom here. But when we were younger, my brother was always getting me in trouble because he could get me to do just about anything that he wanted me to do because I really looked up to my brother, and I still do. Still the smartest guy I know and the best athlete I know and all those things. And so I, in a lot of ways, wanted to be like my older brother. One morning he said to me, Ken, you and I are going to enter into an agreement that each of us is going to say one curse word to our mother before breakfast. I didn't think that was a very good idea, and so I said, no, we're not going to do that. It's not a good idea. He just kept on and on, and I said, finally, okay. I relented. I said, I will do it, but you're going to go first. And he wasn't expecting that because his game plan was to get me to do it, and then he would just be like, I don't know why he talks like that, Mom. But so I turned the tables on him, and so finally he agreed that he would do it too, and he would go first. So we went down to breakfast, and my mom turned to my brother and said, Chris, what do you want for breakfast? And he looked at me like, oh, this is a bad idea. We shouldn't be doing this. And I was like, and so so he looked back at my mom and he said, oh, hell, I guess I'll just have Cheerios. Well, she was very upset with him, right? So she spanked him on the behind because back then you could do that. It was before timeout, right? And then I guess he got timeout too because she sent him to his room and he didn't get to have breakfast. And so then she came back downstairs and kind of whipped her head around at me and said, young man, what are you going to have for breakfast? I hadn't even done anything yet, and she was already mad at me. And so I looked back at her, and with fear in my eyes, I said, I don't know, but you can bet your ass it's not going to be Cheerios. I like that story because, well, it's cute and a little funny, but it also kind of speaks to the point that sometimes we don't learn our lessons when they're literally about to slap us in the face. And I think in a lot of ways, Oklahoma has got lessons to learn, but in a lot of ways, we have learned some lessons as well. I kind of think about where we are today versus where we were in the early 80s. You know, you can't get excited about the future of this state. You know, when you're driving around, if you can't get excited about seeing the developments that are going on in Tulsa, and man, that park that's about to come. I'm coming up for the ribbon cutting for the park that's being developed by the Kaiser Foundation, which is going to be extraordinary for this city. I drive around Oklahoma City, and I see what all has happened there with the MAPS projects and the different developments that are going on there, and you see all these great things that are happening in Oklahoma, and I think sometimes we can focus on the things that aren't going well, the things that we need improvements on, and we forget sometimes what a jewel we have and where we're heading. I was doing that the other day. I was speaking to a group, and I don't even remember where I was or who it was, but I remember I was listening to myself talk, and I was saying, man, I sound really, really negative. I sound really pessimistic because I was complaining about these guys, probably. And then I had to stop myself and catch myself and say, you know, we do have a lot of great things going on in Oklahoma. Yes, we do underfund core services. We underfund education. We don't pay teachers enough. We underfund our infrastructure. Try to drink a cup of coffee in the car in the morning. I did that this morning. You know, it's, you know, we have a lot of issues that we need to do better at. But we are doing well at a lot of things. And if you look at our per capita income and our growth that we're having in our quality of life and those things, I don't want us to forget that, especially with this group, because we want you to stay here, right? We want you to stay in Oklahoma. And we are moving in a good direction. We got a lot of ground to make up. We're still a young state, still got a lot of lessons to learn, but we're moving in a great direction. We are meant to be our own governors, right? We're meant to be our own governors. And some could argue that we could do that a little bit better. And the way that we do that better is just like this. It's just like this. We have to have people like you that are becoming educated voters, because if we're going to govern ourselves, we have to know what we're governing. We have to know what to do. And being informed, getting away from the bumper sticker mentality that is guiding so much of our politics right now, is how we do even better, learn from those lessons, and grow. And so thank you for being here to help us do that. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Anthony Francisco, and I wish I had done like Amanda. Amanda has, you know, Amanda teacher. I should have said Anthony City. You know, because I've listened to the perspective from the academia, I've listened to the perspective from education and from the State House in its various forms. And as I was listening to the economic perspective, and you know, what I heard was a macroeconomic perspective. And what I want to impress upon you, if nothing else, is the difference of your city organization, because where these folks are at the macro level in Oklahoma, I am at the micro level. The city is where you live. Your city council is the closest level of government to you. And while a lot of these issues that were being discussed may seem out of your control, are kind of above your head, the stuff going on at the city is in your control. And the stuff going on at the city are things that affect you directly on a day-to-day basis. When you turned on the water faucet this morning, your city was providing you services. And when you flushed the toilet, your city was providing you services. And when you drove in this morning on some streets, that was the city. When you take your trash out to the curb, that's the city. The services that are being provided by the city are being provided directly to you. Those parks that Mr. Miller talked about, those are city services. So just understand that when we are talking about the city, how many of you live in Norman or go to the University of Oklahoma? Yeah, see a chunk of you. If you're on the University of Oklahoma campus, let's say you're at the library, you are less than a mile from the seat of your city government. And if you didn't know it, every Tuesday evening is the city council meeting, which is what I call open mic night. Because you can walk right up there. We have what's called miscellaneous discussion every city council meeting, and any citizen can come before their city council and address their grievances, whatever they may be. Take advantage of that. Take advantage of this opportunity that you have to not just go a mile up the road and talk to your city councilman, but you have the opportunity right now to speak directly to your state legislators or to your state treasurer or to the OEA executive director. I mean, that's a unique opportunity that you have this morning. You only got 5 minutes or so to do it, but don't blow it. Take advantage of it. I hope you've done like me and taken some notes on some stuff that you want to bring up. Do that. Now's your chance. Grill these guys, okay? Talk about it. City government has some unique challenges as it pertains to fiscal matters. Unlike the state government, which has what I call the three-legged stool of finances, the state government has a nice balance between income tax revenue and production tax revenue and income tax revenue. The city has a two-legged stool: sales tax and other. Now, picture that in your mind. Here's the three-legged stool. Stands pretty well, right? What happens to a two-legged stool? It falls. Yeah. We are extremely dependent for our general fund revenues on sales tax. That's all we get, basically. That's a problem. That is a problem because I'm looking out here in this crowd and I'm seeing about one-third of you with computers in front of your face. And I don't think that we're such captivating speakers as to my thinking that some of you are probably shopping right now. That bothers me. I just, you know, I upset my kids, I upset my wife all the time because as they are online shopping, I am the one pointing out to them that they are killing their city organization. They are killing their local businesses. when they are doing their shopping online in Amazon, which is in Seattle, or some remote site that they are buying from and putting people out of work in their local jurisdiction. You need to think about what you're doing. You need to think about what you're doing. Did you know that when you buy online, you're supposed to pay sales tax, whatever you buy? Did you know that you're supposed to file a tax return at the end of the year with the Oklahoma Tax Commission that talks about what you bought outside of the state of Oklahoma for use within the state of Oklahoma? How many of you knew that? No, that's a lot more than average. Those of you that go to the University of Oklahoma and just raise your hand, you were lying. Because, yeah. And how many of you paid it? Yeah. That is a large and exponentially growing problem that we that depend on sales tax have. And you who are our future policymakers need to understand that and start to address that. This concept that the online retailers are putting out there that we can't pay sales tax because there's all these differing tax rates in all these different jurisdictions, that's a bunch of baloney. Because they know exactly what your buying preferences are, they know where you are, and they know what the tax codes are where you're buying. They can implement a sales tax where they are, and when you buy online, you can comply with the laws that are out there. It's not a new tax, it's enforcement of the taxes that are already on the books. We in Norman have a unique challenge because we can't raise our utility rates without a vote of the people. You're going to hear probably in your time here about State Question 640 and how there has to be a like 3/4 vote to raise taxes or has to go to a vote of the people. We have to go to a vote of the people to raise our utility rates, which are those basic city services that we're talking about. Our customers get to say how much they want to pay. How stupid is that? That's what we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. So before we can go out and spend the multi-millions of dollars that we need to spend to build the facilities that we need to build to provide those services, we got to ask our customers how much they want to pay. How stupid is that? But that's what we have to deal with. Those are all issues that you're going to have to grapple with if you're in Norman or if you're in Oklahoma. And I thank you for taking the challenge of doing it as you go forward in your careers. Thank you.
We have heard from six wonderful panelists, a series of things to think about. And in our time remaining, I believe it would be good for us to as we have been admonished by several of the panelists, to see if we can't suck as much useful information out of them as we possibly can. I would say to Senator Bingaman that if he had wanted to get excited about state government earlier, he should have come to USAO and we would have gotten him involved in politics much earlier than his experience at OU. I'm a kid from OU myself, but I certainly use the latitude to bash my alma mater from time to time. And Representative Inman, I can assure you that the board of OK Policy, there are a bunch of environmentalists, and they do worry constantly about endangered species. I'm going to kick us off here with a general question for really all of the panelists, and I'm not really directing this toward any one of them, but then I'm going to give you folks a chance out there to ask your questions. I have several more queued up if you don't respond with enthusiasm. But here's my question, or I guess it's, I started with a statement. I think I'm accurate, and if I'm not accurate, I want you to correct me, that we in this state do not do a very good job of thinking and planning and acting in light of established strategic visions about where we want to go, what kind of future we want as a state in 10, 20, 30 years. What do we want to be and why? Why is it, if I am correct, and if I'm not, take issue with me, why don't we do a very good job of strategically planning over the long course in terms of raising revenues and spending revenues and prioritizing our areas for spending? How do you respond to that statement?
Who's first?
You certainly may go first.
Well, again, thanks for the question. I think I mentioned earlier, we've got 101 House members, you've got 48 senators plus the governor. So, you know, trying to determine what priorities are, I'm sure you're going to come up with 150 different priorities, you know, in their own mind. Of course, everyone represents, you know, so many thousand citizens, that constituents that you hear from about, you know, what their priorities are. And certainly when you talk about budget, you know, I think, you know, there is a process that we go through. Unfortunately, you know, you take 2008, 2009, for example, when, you know, the bottom fell out of the economy, then whatever goals that you had set out, maybe, you know, every Republicans, Democrats, they all come out with their agenda. They all have some long-term goals, what they would like to see and accomplish. But certainly as finances change, as revenue stream changes, you know, you've got to make, you know, midstream decisions that, you know, affect certain agencies. And unfortunately, the, you know, the economy that I've been through since I've been in the legislature the last 5 years, we've kind of been digging, clawing our way, trying to get out of the hole that we dug. I think the first part of my service in the legislature, we built up a very healthy rainy day fund. We had to access that rainy day fund when things got bad, but now we've replenished that account. So sure, we could do a better job, you know, in long range planning. But again, with so many people, you know, involved in that process, it's hard to, again, you know, the governor comes out with her agenda that she would like to accomplish, and she's got long term goals. And I just think there's just so many people involved. It's hard to, like you would run a business where you've got a chairman, you know, and a board that's in effect for, it's much better, much more efficient. Government is not an efficient operation. So when you've got the House and Senate and the governor at the end of the day, you know, you've got three different agendas that you're working from. And at the end of the day, there's a lot of compromise that's got to take place. And, you know, you hear the old process of making sausage, you know, it's a process that we go through, and at the, you know, the end, you hope it tastes good. So,
yeah, it's a completely flawed system, and this is a nonpartisan statement coming from the minority leader, because when the Democrats ran the state, not much has changed since then. When you have a handful of folks from the governor's office, the pro tem's office, and the speaker's office putting together a budget, and at the same time, you've got major lobbyists, high-powered lobbyists, pushing through all kinds of tax credits and incentives that cost millions and millions of dollars. And then you've got another group of legislators who all they want to do is go back home and say, I cut your taxes. It doesn't matter what it is. They just want to be able to go home and say, I cut your taxes. And so they're clamoring for that. And so the speaker and the pro tem hear lobbyists and their members come in and say, well, I've got to get my bill done, my tax credit. We got to get that through. That's going to create jobs. It's going to be wonderful. Yeah, it's going to cost X number of millions, but it's going to be great. Then they hear from another group that say, hey, if we don't get a tax cut this year, we're in trouble. For example, it wasn't just legislators saying that. Governor Fallon was desperate, in my opinion, this is my editorial comment, desperate to leave this session with a tax cut, because for the first time in state history, Republicans controlled everything. And if there was no tax cut passed this year, then it would have been sort of eye-opening, I guess, for that Republican Party base to go, you guys control everything, and for 4 years you couldn't get a tax cut passed. And so they passed one, but they passed one not looking based upon what's happening this year, but they passed one that takes effect over multiple years in the future, right? So that goes back to the point of, well, there's this budget over here, but there's other things that we want done first. We got to have these credits, we got to have the tax cuts. Then it all gets slapped together at the end, and you get to a system that has only 40 some odd percent of the budget being allocated by the legislature. A bunch more gets taken up off the top because you appease this legislator or this lobbyist or whatever. It is a horrible system. How do you fix it? One way to do it, I know Jerry Askins, when she ran for governor, 4 years ago, she advocated going to a system where we would more or less do budget just 1 year. So you do legislative stuff, what I like to call silly season, where you run all kinds of bills trying to, God knows what, right? We do silly season bills where you just do silly season 1 year, and you'll do the budget that year too. I'm not a big fan of the Texas system where you do a budget 1 year and then we don't see you for 2 years, and until you have an emergency session, you got to come back in and fix it. I think you do budget and silly season 1 year, and then you come back the next year and you just do budget. And what you do there is a couple of things. One, you don't let tax credits and all this and tax cuts and everything else muddy the system. But you also allow for the edification of legislators, because I'll be very honest with you. The vast majority of the folks that we work with are wonderful people, well-intentioned folks on both sides of the aisle, but they struggle balancing their own budget, right? And that's evidenced by the number of them that have filed for bankruptcy in their lifetime, right? They struggle to balance their own budget, let alone understanding what it takes to balance the state budget. And so if they took time in one legislative session and we just said, listen, we're going to sit down with the treasurer, we're going to sit down with folks like David Blatt, and we're just going to put all these numbers and we're going to educate you so that you have a better understanding of how this works, maybe then we'd have better decisions. But right now the system's broke, and I don't see it being fixed anytime soon, because the powers that be, the lobbyists and those folks, it is in their interest to keep the status quo the status quo.
And there's nothing more powerful in the state capitol than the status quo.
That's right.
It wins just about every single time. I think that in general, politicians are not good at setting strategic visions because they're too preoccupied with visions of grandeur. And that speaks to politics, right? The focus is on the short term because it's on the next election cycle. And whether that's the next re-election to the current position that you hold or for the next office that you want to achieve. And so the focus tends to be on what's best politics instead of what's best policy. And to me, that's probably the biggest obstacle that we have I guess just in representative democracy in general. Scott, what you were referring to, I think what my good friend Jerry Askins was proposing at the time was do budget every other year. And I'm completely against that, even though I think Jerry's wonderful. But that is the Texas system. And I think that's not, with such a volatile income streams that we have, primarily the gross production, it is very difficult, as Professor Rickman knows, to forecast revenues for 6 months, much less 24 months. And so that's problematic. I think this new twist was proposed by my replacement in the State House, which was Randy Graw. And he said, why don't we have silly season once every other year and budget every year? And I mean, that's a new idea. I've not heard that one before. Randy actually threw that one out there. Representative Graw threw that one out there. But I think that's worthy of looking at, because to be quite frank, your name for it is pretty good, silly season. And so if we could have less silly season and more focus on the budget, I think that would be a great thing.
I guess I'd just like to add that, you know, when you elect the entire House, or the entire House is up for election every 2 years and half the Senate every 2 years, it doesn't lend itself to long-term planning or long-term campaigning. I think, you know, particularly in education, folks want to, you know, everybody in the legislature for the most part wants to draft bills on education because they feel like they have some understanding of it, because they went to school, and also because their constituents care about it. And so they want to say, look what I've done to help. But I think it's a real problem that, particularly in education, that we're not able or willing to sit back and say, okay, these changes we made, you know, 3-4 years ago, let's see how they pan out. Let's let an entire high school class graduate based on, you know, these standards before we up and change them and decide that they haven't worked. You know, teachers are just sort of pulling their hair out right now as they go back to school, and we, you know, got ready for Common Core and geared up for it, and we, you know, prepared and spent the money and did the, you know, curriculum, and now it's been repealed, and we've got 2 years to come up with the Oklahoma academic standards. We're going to come up with our own standards, and in the meantime, we're kind of in the air about what we're supposed to be doing, and who knows what that's going to look like then. And, you know, the idea of let's maybe implement something for kindergartners and implement it an additional year, you know, each year. Next year it'll be kindergarten and first grade, and then after that kindergarten and second grade, where we can truly see what a new type of education, you know, how that will affect an entire class. It's just completely unrealistic to expect that our government, our state, would have the patience to do something like that. I think term limits has some effect on it, although I know Representative Inman said that it was, you know, similar pre-term limits, I guess, when the Democrats were in power. But you lose so much institutional memory when someone can only be in that building for 12 years. It takes a long time to get up to speed on the number of subjects our legislators are expected to be informed about or experts on, and you know, 5 or 6 years to get up to speed, and then you're looking at the end of your career coming up. We could use more, in my opinion, long-term legislators who've been there to say, look, we've tried that, it didn't work, let me explain why, so, you know, maybe let's not go down that path again.